Athletes love pushing their limits, but intense training can cause serious imbalances. This is exactly what happened to me. My name is Christopher Kelly. When I first entered the world of competitive mountain biking, I became plagued by numerous chronic health issues. So I changed my diet, and I identified my key imbalances with advanced biomedical testing. Before long, I was feeling and competing better than ever. Now, I'm helping other athletes do the same. Welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by not one, not two, but three very special guests. They are my colleagues and coaches over at Nourish Balance Thrive. They are Clay Higgins. Say hi, Clay.
Hi, Clay.
I'm trying to get you so you can recognize the voices here. Zach Moore, our head of strength and conditioning.
Hello, everyone.
And Megan Roberts.
Hi, great to be here.
Today, we are going to be talking about something very special, something that is capable of improving your athletic performance, improving your mood, improving your testosterone levels, improving your blood glucose regulation, fatigue, productivity, stress tolerance, and gut health. Can you think of one thing that would do all of that? What would it be? Nicotinamide riboside? The paleo diet? Maybe. It's sleep and circadian rhythm. And we've written, I say we, like the royal we, Megan has written a fantastic article that we published on the blog a few weeks ago. And I will, of course, link to that in the show notes that you can find over at nourishbalancethrive.com/podcast. But today we thought we'd talk about the article from a practical concern. So all of the guys that I have with me now have been working one-on-one with clients of our elite performance program. So rather than this being a theoretical discussion of the factors that lead to good or bad sleep, it's going to be more of a practical discussion of the things that we've seen working with clients one-on-one. So I hope that's helpful. Let's get stuck into it. So the idea of a circadian rhythm was well described in a recent podcast with Tommy and Greg Potter. I know you guys listened to that podcast. It was a really fantastic episode. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoy Greg, and I obviously really enjoy Tommy. Do you think we really need to revisit that and discuss what a circadian rhythm is? I think it might, just for the sake of completeness, I think it's maybe nice to just talk about what a circadian rhythm is. Megan, do you want to talk about what a circadian rhythm is?
Sure. So in a very general sense, circadian rhythm refers to our body's biological clocks. And those clocks, we have kind of a master clock in our brain, and then each of our organs have their own circadian clocks. And each of those clocks as a whole tell us when it's time to sleep, when it's time to be awake. So that's the basis of a circadian rhythm. Now, that's a little bit different from sleep drive, which tells us kind of how much sleep we want and how much sleep that we desire. So those are the kind of the differences between the two.
Yeah, I thought the discussion about just the definition of the word is kind of interesting. Circa, which I think most people will recognize as meaning about, and then DN, a day. And that's kind of interesting. Why is it only about a day, not exactly a day? Right, so this kind of leads to the discussion of things that would entrain a circadian rhythm so that we all run on the same 24-hour clock. Super interesting. But before we get into maybe some of those details, can you talk about why sleep is so important? And let me ask you that, Zach, actually. So your focus primarily working with clients is body composition and strength and conditioning. Like, how have you seen that be transformative? What an incredibly loaded question this is.
I was going to say, thanks for asking
I'll
me
just
first.
Stop talking
Chris.
Now.
Yeah. No, so in my realm, I mean, sleep is super important just for one, for recovery. So to be at your best, to perform at your best, you need recovery. And sleep is obviously a huge component of that. So some of the athletes we work with, if they are feeling tired, fatigued, something like that, I always want to know that because I will immediately decrease the volume that they're performing in their athletics or suggest certain changes in their program because I know they're not going to be at their best.
Right.
And
can you give me a specific example of somebody that came to you with a body composition goal and it seems like they're doing everything right in terms of their diet, but they weren't hitting their goals because they weren't getting enough sleep? Have you ever seen that in practice?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. I've seen clients who, for one, when you're trying to lose weight or, you know, improve body composition, sometimes hunger can become an issue. And when you are sleep deprived, then, I mean, what the research shows is hunger is definitely even stronger when you are sleep deprived. So I've had clients who, when they are not sleeping well, they feel overly hungry, more so than usual. And then that makes losing fat more challenging or improving body composition. But when they get their sleep in line, then they don't have the cravings as often. You know, they can go between meals and not feel as cranky and things like that. It just, it helps with cravings. So it's definitely a super important variable that makes those things easier.
Mm-hmm. And I can cite some references in the show notes that sleep deprivation affects hunger and satiety hormones. It also affects glucose tolerance. And I know, Clay, that you've spent a lot of time looking at your own glucose tolerance and that of other clients. Mm-hmm. Is that something you've seen in practice? Again, a very leading question because I know the answer, but talk about how have you seen that where someone just can't figure out why the blood glucose is all wonky and they're like, oh, it's almost as if what I put in my mouth has no effect. And then it's really about the sleep deprivation. Is that something you've seen?
Absolutely, because with exercise and food, those are two big drivers and people want to focus on that a lot. Whereas if you could get people to focus on one thing and one thing only, it would be sleep.
Mm.
I see it as the top of the pyramid. I mean, evolutionarily, you can't cheat that. Everyone feels the effects of even one night of bad sleep. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a big win for people when they can get their sleep in line. And a lot of times that does take a while, but if you can begin to set a proper bedtime and work towards it and have things that help you rest better, the insulin, to me, from what I've seen, not follows, but it gets it in line a little better.
Just to pop in there on the glucose tolerance, what I've seen is sometimes it's a food timing thing. So just simply front loading your calories and not having a larger dinner, you know, 1 hour before you go to sleep can make a whole lot of difference. And then the other thing is carbohydrate timing as well. You know, more front loading your carbs, you are more insulin sensitive. And this is one thing that Tommy and Greg talked about.
Yeah. So it's, you buy Carb Backloaded by Kiefer and then you just do the opposite of everything it says in the book. It's a fantastic book. You just need to invert it.
Right.
And actually, you reminded me of a woman that I worked with for a while, and we seemed like we'd exhausted every opportunity to make her blood glucose tolerance better. You know, like done all the tests, all the things. Eventually, that's what it is. She's like, all I needed to do was eat dinner at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and my fasting blood glucose is 79 or something, where previously she'd looked like pre-diabetic. Quite extraordinary. And it was not to do with the food choices. It was just to do with the timing, which is unbelievable. There's an unbelievable list of things here I can link to in this article. Athletic performance, insulin resistance, glucose tolerance, obesity, hunger and satiety hormones I already mentioned, the gut microbiota, cognitive and motor performance, general hormonal balance, male and female reproductive hormones, cortisol, cardiovascular dysfunction and disease risk, perceptions of attractiveness. That's an interesting one. I didn't notice that in the article when I read it for the first time. Tell us about what you learned when you put that in the article.
It's been a while since I read the study, but there was a study that looked at, they showed participants different pictures and when they were sleep deprived versus when they were not sleep deprived. And these were pictures of people's faces. They perceived attractiveness in a different way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's absolutely amazing. And then so we've also got mood, cancer, immune function, Alzheimer's disease, neurogenesis, aging and its associated diseases. That's like quite a long list of things to care about sleep for, right? So the next question is then, like, so how do I know if I'm getting enough quality sleep? Like, how do you go about that, Megan, assessing whether someone's getting enough quality sleep?
Two things that kind of lead into this discussion. One is some people come to us and they're obviously not getting enough. They're having the symptoms and they know it. Other people are coming to us and like, oh yeah, I can function just fine off of 5.5 hours of sleep. And we have to have this conversation of, well, is that really true? Have you tried to lengthen the time that you're sleeping to see if some of these problems that you're having resolve? So if you are getting enough, you don't fall asleep the moment your head hits the pillow, but you also don't lie in bed for an hour waiting to fall asleep. You also don't wake up multiple times during the night. So sometimes waking up periodically is normal, but you don't want to be waking up multiple times, having to go to the bathroom and whatnot. You also wake up feeling refreshed. Men, your testosterone meter would point north and your energy level is typically consistent throughout the day. And one thing I will say is sometimes I get people kind of coming to me and they're saying, well, I get really, really tired after dinner. And I go, well, that's typically when the sun goes down. You're supposed to be getting more tired in the evening. So just your energy level should decline during the second half of the day, kind of when you're supposed to be sleeping. But during the time of day when you're awake, doing your everyday functions and activities, then you should have a relatively consistent level of energy.
Can I ask you, is there a female equivalent of the testosterone meter? I honestly don't know the answer to that question. It's the first question I've asked where I really don't know the answer.
It would be libido or it would be missing periods.
Okay.
You know, so nothing that you could really, you know.
Not quite as...
Not as obvious, but right. It does.
And so what should people do then? Let's start with falling asleep. You put your head on the pillow. So Clay, I know you've got some thoughts about this. Like, so your mind is racing and maybe either you're ruminating over the day's events or maybe you're thinking forwards to what might be happening tomorrow. Like, have you got any tips that people might use so they can shut down the monkey mind and get to sleep?
Having the routine, the bedtime routine, it can be simple cues such as making tea or things of that nature. But the big ones are not exposing yourself to blue light.
Right. And we'll get into that. We'll get into that.
Okay. And the routine is really big because, and it actually starts the minute you wake up. But if you can build in that time, whether it's an hour or 2 hours, that does calm the monkey mind down.
Right.
Breathing techniques help with that as well.
Right. What type of breathing techniques have you been using?
Maybe like a box breathing.
Okay. Can you describe that? I'm not.
Yeah. So think of like the four sides of the box. Some people do where it's a 1-to-1 ratio.
Okay.
1-to-1-to-1-to-1 ratio of 4 in, 4 hold, 4 exhalation. I prefer a really long exhalation. And as a matter of fact, as long as you want, that just really kind of kicks in the parasympathetic. Mm. And that's actually good for stress at any time, but it's the old counting sheep, you know, it's counting the same four sheep. So yeah. And it's really good because I have personally had success with that, but I don't have monkey mind a lot because I have that routine that comes into that. And it's odd. I've always had the, when it's time to go to sleep, it's time to go to sleep because that's gold.
Right.
And so if it's not being solved right now, it's not going to get solved by ruminating.
Uh-huh.
So, but I understand that's a tough thing for
me. I find that writing things down is sometimes very helpful. Yeah. I think I first got this tip from Dr. Kurt Parsley that was on the podcast many moons ago. Mm-hmm. And I can link to that in the show notes. But yeah, I mean, so I've got tons of things I've been thinking about and things I might want to get done first thing in the morning. It's just so simple, isn't it? You just write them down. I mean, there's some part of your subconscious mind is worried about forgetting something. And so that's like almost giving rise to the rumination where you just realize you're having the same thought over and over again. Like, oh, I've been here before 30 seconds ago. Just write it down. And then suddenly it's almost like some part of your brain gives you permission just to stop thinking about it. Zach, I know that you've got an 18-month-old baby. It is 18 months, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And so just turned 18 months.
And I know that can be, from personal experience, that can be very challenging. Can you talk about some of the difficulties that you face getting to bed when you've got a kid of that age with you?
Yeah, we've actually been really lucky. He sleeps really well now. In the first few months, it was pretty challenging getting up, things like that. One thing that we'll probably touch on a little later is blue blocking glasses. Mm. So in the middle of the night when he wakes up,
do all the same things for him?
No, for myself. I put on blue blockers to get him. For him.
Oh, so if you've got to get up, I get it.
Yeah, to like go help or, you know, my wife would breastfeed and things like that. But sometimes I would want to support her or get the diaper or something like that. So I would get up with
her. Oh,
you're
way better than me. I'd be like snoring logs in the
car. I know. Sorry, guys, if your wife's listening. But yeah, so I would do that. But the big thing was exactly what Clay touched on, like getting your child in a routine, if you have one, trying to have kind of a similar wind down routine each night. So they get used to that. They get sleepy at that same time, getting up around the same. I mean, obviously a baby, you can't force that at all, but you can kind of get those same routines down. But for myself personally, I mean, like I said, the blue blockers, the same strategies we'll probably touch on, but getting light first thing in the morning, just to set my circadian rhythm, trying to avoid dark light at night. But you do the best you can when you have a baby. Like I said, you're not going to be fully in control of that. And that's what I would say too, this is with any habit you're trying to take on, is focus only what's in your control, right? Because some things may be out of your control. You just can't do anything. Shift work, for example.
Right.
Maybe you can't do anything about that. So yeah, it can be hard with a kid, but there are things you can do to just get as much sleep as you can.
I've been very lucky with that as well. And I wonder whether some of it, I know you've spent some time hanging out with Paul Jaminet, who's also been on the podcast. I remember one of the things that he talked about was nap time. Like, yeah, let them have their naps, but don't try and confuse them by having them sleep in a darkened room. Like, the temptation is to draw the curtains. And I don't do that. Like, Ivy and Bauer both nap in a light room and then they just wake up naturally. But
that's exactly what we do.
That is exactly what you do.
That's what we do as well. And
of course, you've no idea whether it's working or not.
But, no.
But it seems to make sense, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. Because again, I mean, dark signals to us that it's time to sleep. So, right. I mean, especially for a kid that doesn't know what time of day it is, if they get used to taking a nap when it's dark in your room, then they're not going to know really when it's night. That may be two different nights to them.
Right.
So letting them sleep when the light's coming in the window or something like that, I think that's a really just powerful signal to them. Just like us, they have that same kind of cycle. So yeah, I didn't really think about that. That's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found it really helpful just for all of us to go to bed at the same time. Mm-hmm. My parents did that thing where we had to go to bed really early and then they did whatever they did after we went to bed. I guess some parents, like maybe if you're working, you don't get home from 7 o'clock or something, then you want that alone time or you want any time. But I don't know, like I really value the sleep so much based on all the things we've already talked about, right?
Well, and that's
I value those more than anything.
Yeah, and that's the temptation is, like you said, you have a few hours before bed to just relax with your spouse or by yourself or whatever it is. But those hours are usually not very productive, especially if you're sleep deprived.
Yeah.
So over time, not getting to bed, you are only saving yourself these hours that are going to be not productive. Whereas if you went to bed, then you could get up, be more productive in your time. So it really creates more time in the long run if you just get to bed.
Right. And you're just more productive. You'll make it up the next day with increased productivity.
Yes.
Yeah, I found that super helpful. We go to bed at 8:30 at night, like, or whenever it gets dark is kind of when we go to bed.
We had an issue at first with my son where he thought night was like 6 p.m. So we were going to bed super early, but luckily we slowly pushed him back over time, but we stuck to that schedule because that was to him, that was night, and we wanted that 24-hour cycle or roughly 24-hour cycle. But over time, the light really helped kind of reset that. And he was born in January, so it was dark out more often anyway, so that made it more challenging. Yeah. But yeah, so it would get dark earlier. At 6 p.m.
Right. We're definitely going to bed earlier in the winter, like following more of that natural cycle. And yeah, Ivy goes to bed immediately. Like she falls asleep really quickly. And then when I lift her out of the bed, she goes to sleep in my bed. And then I lift her out into a little toddler bed that's next to our bed. And she's like a corpse. It's like literally picking up a dead body to move into the thing. So she's really, really sleeping hard. I know that older kids, I know, Claire, you've got teenagers and that's a whole different ball of wax, right? And I don't really know anything about that yet.
It's just the opposite of what you're talking about. So it flips again. The newborn's confused day and night, and then it goes back to that. But they still need their sleep. And I think personally from we always set that early bedtime, and they still, teenagers will push it out, but they still, if you develop that habit at a young age, it sticks with them.
Right. And I was just about to say that I was talking to a doctor here at AHS, we're in Bozeman, Montana, recording. And I'd just been talking to a dentist there, Kevin Boyd, who I'm hoping to have on the podcast. And he said, oh, that regular routine you've got with your kids, do not change that. Like, you need to stick to that schedule. And you'll really thank me for that advice in a long time. Like, it's not so obvious now, but in the future, it will be important. Let's talk about some of the things that might disrupt circadian rhythm. The main one being light. Do you want to talk about how light might disrupt circadian rhythm?
Sure. So of all the things that are potentially going to disrupt circadian rhythm, too much blue light at night and then not enough bright outdoor light, natural light during the day are probably the two biggest things. Now, blue light has a higher energy, shorter wavelength light than something like a red or an orange light. And studies have shown that the more outdoor, natural, bright light we can get in the beginning half of our day, the more resilient we'll be to any blue light that kind of sneaks in at night. Obviously, preferably, we don't have that blue light at night, but just the fact that getting outside first thing in the morning, which is something that I encourage a lot of people to do, helps with that resiliency in the evening, is certainly something to consider. Mm.
I've talked to lots of people that at this point, they know about the light at night problem, and they've installed f.lux, and they've got the special sunglasses and all the rest of that jazz. But what they're not really concentrating on is the fact, I mean, what you said just a moment ago before I cut you off is that a great night of sleep starts first thing in the morning and getting that bright light first thing in the morning. And maybe you need to alter your environment in some way such that you do have a trigger, right, that pushes you outside. And that could be as simple as, do you drink coffee? Do you drink tea? Or can you drink that first cup of coffee or tea outside on the stoop in front of your house? Like, that seems like a pretty simple thing. I mean, I like walking the dog, and I've talked about that on the podcast before, and that works great, but I realize that's not for everyone. Zach, what about you? Have you got any tips for getting people outside first thing in the morning?
Well, I mean, one kind of issue I see come up a lot is people who work in an office, and right, this isn't touching on the first thing in the morning, but every little bit adds up. So if you can just get outside occasionally, take little mini breaks and just walk outside and maybe take a lunch break outside,
like smoke
if you
a cigarette
can.
Outside.
Yeah,
something.
Yeah, that's what I meant. No, do not do that. But yeah, just walk around the building, or I mean, maybe ask a coworker to go outside with you. I mean, just every little bit adds up, and I don't think people, or they don't think that's going to make a difference. But again, it cumulatively, it will definitely add up. So I'd recommend that. I mean, even if you're inside the office, or if you have the ability to open your window a little bit if the weather's nice out, just any of that is going to be beneficial.
Mm-hmm. We were listening to Ben Greenfield yesterday talk about all his hacks. And he was actually very good. You know, he has all these gadgets that shines light up your nose and up your bum and all the rest of it. And then he did this interesting thing where it's like, I've tried all these things and they do have their utility, but you know what? You can just go outside and like, yeah, I think I'll just take my laptop outside. That seems like a great solution. And it took me a while to realize this, but even when you're indoors and it seems like a well-lit room, if you were to get out a light meter, you would see that it's an order of magnitude dimmer in there than if you go outside, even on a dark day. But it's your pupils are going to adjust to the amount of available light. And that's maybe part of what causes the confusion, or people don't know that they need to spend more time outside.
And that's what I'd say too. Yeah, if it is very cloudy out, it looks super dark, that's still much brighter than what you're experiencing indoors, even with a ton of light.
Resist the temptation to say what the heck and not bother going outside just because it's a bit cloudy. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make sense. Let's talk about caffeine. What role does caffeine have to play in all of this, Megan?
Generally, we know that caffeine too late in the day can certainly be detrimental for our sleep. A general rule of thumb that I give our clients and people in general is to cut off caffeine intake at noon and see how that either makes your sleep better or no change at all. And then if you do find that makes your sleep better, then slowly cut it off a couple hours before noon and see if that dramatically increases your sleep even more than that. Some people need to take a complete break from caffeine, and that's really fine. And it's also, the metabolism of caffeine depends on things like genetics and also individual tolerance and how much caffeine you usually drink. There's a lot kind of playing into it, but shifting caffeine intake throughout the day can be beneficial.
Whereabouts does that lie in the order of things? Is that the first thing you try, the last thing you try? Depends on the person.
It depends on the person. If they're having multiple cups of coffee in the afternoon, then it's one of the first things.
Yeah.
Even if they say, oh, I can drink coffee at 3 p.m. and it not affect my sleep.
Yeah. Zach, would you ever recommend to someone that they use caffeine as an ergogenic aid before they hit the gym?
If it's not too late in the day, possibly. Yeah. So, I mean, it has been shown to be helpful for performance. If you're not already used to it or consuming it a lot, you do kind of adjust to it and it doesn't really become helpful in that regard. But right, if someone's training late in the day, I would absolutely not recommend it. And also you have to ask yourself, I mean, if you're not consistently using it, then you're going to have a certain amount of performance, which is going to be kind of a stress on your body. And then if you have the caffeine and maybe it provides a little bit of performance for a while, that's just not that super helpful in the long run. So if someone has like a game day or something they're really prepping for, then maybe that's helpful in that regard. But I don't recommend it consistently over time, unless it's just part of your morning routine. But like Megan said, sleep is definitely more important than that.
This is another one of those things. I had a story where someone had exhausted all avenue of possibility, and then finally they try and changing their meal times, and they discovered that was the thing with blood glucose. I've definitely had the same thing with caffeine and sleep. Like, oh yeah, we fixed all these other things, and I'm feeling much better, but still not sleeping great. And then they'll come back and say, you know what? It's caffeine. And it's like, you'd think it'd be the first thing you try. And it's not. Tell us what you do, Clay. How about that? Rather than telling us what we should do.
Personally, so half calf can work. Sometimes some people don't like that.
Swiss decaf. We talked about that in the other podcast, right?
Absolutely.
Swiss water process.
I'm big on the green teas, matcha. things of that nature.
And do you find they have a different effect? Like, I definitely find, even when I've been habitually drinking a lot of tea, that there's still something special about coffee. And I wouldn't like to say it's just caffeine, but I don't have coffee at home. I just don't have it in the house. And then I have it when I go out. And it's kind of like a special thing then.
For me, I like to switch it off and just maybe almost have a coffee holiday. And sometimes that makes me, I don't know if it makes me like it even more, but you know, it just gives you a break. But I certainly enjoy the lift that I get from matcha, or if I wanted something with lunch, it'd be green tea, or just kind of switching it up too. Cause you never know. It's, again, it's one of those things. We're just asking that you try it.
Yeah.
See how you feel.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? If you were one of these people like me, I've got a real habit of drinking hot beverages, even in the afternoon and even at night. And so I'll just switch to something that doesn't have caffeine in it. And you kind of don't really notice, do you? As long as it's relatively tasty. There's so many different great teas on the market we have access to now. It's like, why not try some of them?
Yeah.
Rubiose is one of my favorites. You know, it's part of Brian's detox protocol, and I bought some for that. I'm like, wow, this is actually really good. And I've been drinking it quite regularly since then. Let's talk about alcohol. Are you a boozy person, Megan? You don't really strike me as much of a boozer.
I'm not. Alcohol is not really my thing. It doesn't agree with me. And in the context of sleep, a lot of people think that alcohol has sedative properties, and it does. It can help you fall asleep faster, but it actually causes more disruption in sleep during the second half of the night.
Right. What do you mean when you say it doesn't agree with you? In what way?
Alcohol does cause intestinal permeability, and I found in particular that it doesn't. My gut doesn't like it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. And the other thing alcohol can do is suppress melatonin and also change your core body temperature, which we know both of those, melatonin and a decrease in core body temperature, are important for sleep onset. Mm.
What about you, Zach? Is it kind of an immediate red flag when you've got someone drinking? If they've got any kind of goal, it does seem like low-hanging fruit, doesn't it?
Yes, yes. And a lot of people, you know, they'll use it to wind down. It helps them relax in the evening. They feel like that helps them sleep easier, but your quality of sleep is worse than what it would be if you hadn't drank. So it may give you that false sense of, oh, I'm winding down, I'm relaxing, but it doesn't really help with your sleep long term. So again, I would definitely, you know, Clay touched on this earlier, just shutting your mind off, finding other ways to relax and calm down before bed. So that's what I usually work on with clients, that you do use alcohol as a way to de-stress before bed, is finding other mediums, whether that's going for a walk, doing some maybe light, gentle stretching, just nothing that amps you up, maybe even taking a warm bath, or, you know, just whatever that is to kind of calm the person down.
It's one of those things where it's probably easier said than done, right? Like, if you're used to drinking half a bottle of red wine every night, it's no good me just saying, oh, just stop it and you'll sleep great, don't worry about it. Yeah, that's a whole area of research trying to get people to stop doing that. But I have to say that we've seen at least a couple of examples that I can think of where Dr. Simon Marshall, who's been on the podcast a couple of times, has had really fantastic results helping people who have already decided. He doesn't tell anyone to do anything. That's like one of the hallmarks of Simon, is you never get him to tell you to do anything. But he has helped people who have already decided that they want to stop drinking or cut back on their drinking. And he has some fantastic evidence-based techniques that he uses to do that, that I will resist the temptation to get into now. Or I will recommend one thing, the Charles Duhigg book, I think is very powerful. Like, understanding how habits are formed, how they're triggered, how you go through a routine and then there's a reward. And then even from that book, you'll get some ideas about how you might be able to modify that routine. For example, by substituting the red wine or beer or whatever it is you're drinking with perhaps something that has a similar mouthfeel, and then replacing the alcohol reward with some other type of reward. So the Charles Duhigg book, I'll link in the show notes.
And one thing I just want to pop in here and say, there's certainly a time and a place to enjoy alcohol, and you kind of have to weigh the pros and the cons. So if you're having a dinner party and you're with friends and you're socializing and you want to have a glass or two of wine, you have to weigh, you know, the pros of being social and that connection with other people to potentially maybe a night of not so great sleep. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, you reminded me of the Malcolm Kendrick podcast where he talked about moderate alcohol consumption. Whatever that is, maybe there's a difference between people who are drinking scotch by themselves in a dark room versus a family in France having a small glass of red wine with dinner. It's like kind of a very different scenario. And yeah, it's difficult.
It gets into the deeper conversation of why.
Yeah. So where do neurotransmitters come into this, Megan? Do you think there's a possibility that somebody might have a neurotransmitter imbalance that could be affecting their sleep?
Potentially. Yeah, there is some evidence to suggest that stress, whether that's chronic stress from over exercising or stress from something else can cause an imbalance in neurotransmitters, which are these little tiny chemical messengers that help transmit signals throughout the nervous system. And we need like specific neurotransmitters are precursors to melatonin. So,
okay. Clay, talk about your bedroom environment. How have you shaped your bedroom environment to make it more conducive towards quality sleep?
One of the first things that I did was change the light bulbs out.
That's an important one, isn't it? That was kind of one of the first things I did. And I'm not particularly sensitive to caffeine, but light is like
huge.
Huge.
Yeah. And the I believe it's the Sylvania who makes them. There's a few on the market that you can find on Amazon, but you know, they're low blue.
Okay.
And you can still read. You can still, you know, you're not going to stumble on kicking the dog across the room, but getting the house right too. I mean, and whether that's a chili pad or the temperature in the house. I live in the South. It gets really hot, so you have to cool the house a lot. And so that can be disturbing. So you have to, like your environment, we're fortunate where we are in Bozeman. You just pop open the window. It's nice and chilly.
Oh, it's the same in Northern California. We're so lucky. It gets very hot during the day, especially in the summer. But at night, all you need to do is open the window and it's 55, 60 degrees every night. And so it cools off really wonderfully.
Yeah. And if light pollution is an issue where you live,
yeah, blackout curtains.
Taking steps for that or even the sleep mask.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a big one. If your bed partner likes to read and there's the, you know, there's light still going on, and that helps as well. So white noise can help.
Yeah, I was going to say, we have a HEPA air filter that's quite a nice, doubles as a white noise generator. Mm-hmm. But I had to get some duct tape and, you know, had all these LED lights on the front of it, completely meaningless and unnecessary LED lights. And I had to get duct tape and, yeah, so making it as dark as possible.
Yep.
That's almost a thing in hotel rooms, isn't it? They love to give you a radio alarm clock and all this other stuff with LEDs in it. It's like a little task that, you know, little job to go around the hotel room, getting rid of all these lights.
Walk in the hotel room, turn the lights off, find them all.
Yeah.
Tape them off.
Yeah. What kind of mattress have you got, Zach? Do you think that's important?
To be honest, I don't even know. I'm pretty frugal, so I have just kind of a hand-me-down. But I'm definitely big on turning the temperature down. Like Clay said, like it has to be cool enough for me to sleep well. We do have blackout curtains, and I'm a big fan of a night mask. Those are kind of my three go-tos. I travel with the night mask everywhere because you just... In a hotel room, I mean, if that's where you're staying, like lights come through the blinds like crazy. It's impossible to filter out all the light.
Right. So. God, I'm so lucky I live in Bonnie Doon. We don't even have curtains because we don't need them.
No, we have street lights and stuff like that. So blackout curtains are really helpful. Again, especially for my son, because I'm not going to put a blackout mask on his eyes. But so it just, you know, it makes him think it's still dark out. So
what's the biggest problems that you've had to solve working with clients, Megan?
In terms of bedroom environment?
Yeah, exactly. Is there something, anything that pops out? It's one of those things that people have already thought about for the most part, isn't it? And they've usually gone to considerable effort to improve their bedroom environment before.
Typically, yes. I think one thing that's, it's actually a struggle in my house is one partner likes it hot, one partner likes it cold. So figuring out kind of a happy medium between those.
Oh, yeah, you've talked about that, haven't you? You and your husband have like got a slight disagreement over the temperature of the bedroom.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about obstructive sleep apnea. That's definitely something that we've seen for a number of our clients. I feel like I can spot it on a blood chemistry now because you see suspiciously elevated hemoglobin. You're like, somebody that has all these health complaints doesn't normally have, it's like almost a hallmark of chronic disease is low hemoglobin. And why is this person so high, especially the men? It's kind of suspicious. Can you tell me what you know and what you've seen?
Yeah. So obstructive sleep apnea is where during some part of the night, the airways in your upper respiratory system become blocked. And so you're not getting enough oxygen. And this can cause awakenings during the night and also lead to poor sleep quality. There are specific risk factors for sleep apnea. So these include alcohol consumption, smoking, overweight, and obesity. But apart from kind of that suspiciously high hemoglobin that we see on the blood chemistry calculator, you can also just get inexpensive
pulse oximeter
on Amazon and check those blood oxygen saturation levels.
Right. And it's not practical to sleep all night, but you probably don't need to. You just take a nap with this little finger trap device attached to your finger, and then you get an idea of whether there are any apneas taking place. And it can lead to a proper sleep study and a diagnosis and a CPAP machine, which is not ideal, but if you're not sleeping right, then you can't reasonably expect anything else to improve until you get that sorted.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be hope. So the dentist that I mentioned earlier, Kevin Boyd, presented wonderful data on the amazing shrinking face. And this may be part of it, right? Is people's faces are actually getting smaller. The airway is becoming more constricted and more people are having problems with mouth breathing during the night. And I'm actually one of those people. I have a nasal injury that I think I picked up kickboxing a long time ago. And the Breathe Right strip is like, was transformative to my sleep. It's just a little sticky, we call them nose stickers. You put this thing on your nose and it just opens up the airways a bit. And I feel like it's really helped me. Clay, I know that you've tried the mouth taping thing. Can you tell us about that?
Mixed.
Mixed results, really?
Yeah, yeah. It's one of those things I'm like, I got to try that. And so I shoot Tommy a message. Tommy, have you tried it? So we had a conversation about it. And I was like,
aren't we lucky? Like, yeah. Isn't it awesome to have Tommy in your Slack?
Yeah. Like, Tommy, sometimes what do you think?
We're on a client call, any one of us, and somebody asks a question. We don't know the answer. I said, I don't know the answer to that. I need to get back to you. And then you ask Tommy in Slack, and then you get the answer for them before you've even got off the call. It's the coolest thing.
It turned out we had both tried it in around the same time.
Okay.
Yeah, I was like, you know, I tried this. I can't even explain it other than I slept deeper.
Okay.
I felt refreshed when I woke up. I don't know if it was just those few nights. I tried it for a little bit, but I can't.
You're not doing it now. And Tommy's not doing it now.
I did it last night.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
And who knows?
And what are you using? Have you got the special?
Yeah.
So how I found out about this was through our mutual friend and previous podcast guest, Mike Mutzel, who does fantastic things over at High Intensity Health. And he's talked about mouth taping extensively. Did you buy the special thing that he talks about?
That's where I fell prey to advertising.
Clay's like your man. Like, if you want to know, like, the gadget, the thing, the replacement food, the best chocolate, coffee, anything like that, like, Clay always knows all the best things.
I have so many notes now from this trip that I'm going to contact Clay afterwards and be like, Clay, what was that product? What was that supplement? What? Yeah.
He would be a great salesman. You're like a salesman that's not actually selling things. Have you seen this? He like opens his coat and he's got this big extensive panel of things on the inside. Like, tell us about the drip coffee. You're very excited about the pour. Is it called again?
Drip Kit.
Drip Kit.
Drip Kit. So if you're a fan of pour over before noon.
obviously.
So they've partnered with a few different coffee roasters to make a kit for travel. And all you need is the hot water. Or if you're camping or what have you.
Oh, yeah. I bet it's great for camping. Yeah,
exactly. Because there's really no messy cleanup. Comes in a foil pack. It's a single serve. You just put it over the cup, pour the hot water. And
that's cool.
Yeah, it's really good. I always like to just try it and see if
you are
like
a try it. And see. You're am, a tinkerer. A tinkerer I, is the perfect
I,
word for you.
I am so.
Let's talk about nocturia. This is a very interesting word that I may have just added an extra syllable to. I can explain. Everybody knows what it is. It's just getting up in the night to pee. And I used to be very, very good at this. And I would get up multiple times in the night to pee. Eventually, I kind of figured out that it wasn't that I was being woken up by the urge to pee. It's that I was waking up and then you're like, oh, actually, I need to pee. And Megan, I know this question comes up a lot. And it's another one of those things where people think because it's common, it's normal or optimal or expected. And we don't think that's true, right? And Megan, you've done some research on this. Can you tell us about that?
So as far as the research goes, I was looking at specific mechanisms that could potentially be causing this problem. The other thing to say is sometimes the answer isn't to directly go and try to solve it. The answer is to work on all these other things that we're talking about, and then this kind of falls into place.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like the mercury in the thermometer, trying to push it back down into the bulb is not going to help solve the problem, right?
Right. It's a symptom of a bigger problem. But as far as mechanisms go, there's a hormone, aldosterone, that is supposed to be high at night, and it causes retention of sodium and water. And low aldosterone, which can be due to something like cortisol dysregulation, can potentially cause waking up in the middle of the night to have to use the bathroom. And the kind of catch-22 here is that sleep deprivation itself can block the nighttime increase in cortisol that's supposed to happen, making this a whole vicious cycle. Another potential mechanism is cortisol spikes that can lead to an inhibition of a hormone called ACTH, which can then decrease aldosterone and cause this nocturia.
Mm-hmm. Do you buy into the idea that maybe cortisol, that was how I felt when I woke up in the middle of the night. It was like I'd just been woken up by somebody breaking into the house. You know what I mean? It was like that kind of feeling. And with it came hunger. And so I always wondered whether there may be a cortisol spike. Do you think it's possible that my blood sugar was dropping and then maybe cortisol had kicked in to raise it? Or is that a bit too naive to...
No, I think that's very possible. Something like a continuous blood glucose monitor at night could potentially help kind of diagnose that.
That's an interesting idea, isn't it? Although we've talked about that on the podcast before, there may not be documented hypoglycemia. Tommy had some really interesting ideas on that. The brain is regulating that system so tightly, it's not going to let anything bad happen.
Right.
So really, when you experience hypoglycemic symptoms, it's the rapid change that you notice. So my analogy is, imagine you're a pilot in a plane and the plane is nosediving towards the earth. And then you pull back on the stick and you feel that negative G-force and you're like, whoa! And you never hit the ground, but you do feel the effects of the negative G-force. So you may not see. So what I'm trying to say is that you may not see hypoglycemia. Like if you're expecting to see 40 milligrams per deciliter on your blood glucose meter, you may never see it. It's the rapid transition from 140 to 80, maybe less of a change than that, that you'll notice.
Right. One other thing here is the body should be producing less urine at night, which is probably due to these hormones that we talked about. And if you're not truly in a deep sleep, then that could ultimately be part of the mechanism by which you're having to wake up and go to the bathroom due to a full bladder. Right. Or you're waking up and then you notice your bladder's full.
Right. So it's really just a symptom.
And that kind of goes back to the whole circadian rhythm thing we were talking about. It's night. Your body needs to believe it's night. And if you're eating at night or seeing blue light at night, all of these things, your body's not going to get that signal that it's nighttime, and then it may not follow that mechanism, which it should. Mm-hmm. So
maybe this is a good time to just summarize a little bit. So the things we talked about: avoid blue light at night. Everybody knows about that at this point, right? F.Lux, your blue blocking glasses. Go outside first thing in the morning. Very important. It's much brighter outside than it is indoors. So you've got to get outside. Eating when the sun is up. We've not talked too much about this. So perhaps this is a good time to explore this a little bit more deeply. I'm a huge fan of the early time restricted eating, not just for its effects on my sleep, which do seem to be noticeable, but I quite like eating dinner at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, actually. You know, like, I think all old people like eating dinner early, but they torture themselves by waiting till 6 or 7 o'clock at night. And what we're saying here is you can just do what you want to do and have dinner at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I think it's all good news. So one of the things I think about, Megan, talk about what kind of resistance do you meet when you say to people, hey, so what I want you to do is eat breakfast like a king, lunch like,
Prince.
Is it Prince? And then dinner like a pauper.
Yeah.
What kind of resistance do you get when you suggest this to people?
Right. So a lot of it is lifestyle related. A lot of people find that just if they want to do some kind of intermittent fasting, that skipping a breakfast is easier than skipping a dinner. Maybe that's because they're working late or because they just like having that family dynamic at dinner when they're home from work. That's typically the most resistance that I get. The other thing is some people just say, well, I'm not hungry at breakfast. Mm-hmm. And I usually counter that with, well, if you ate an earlier dinner, then you would probably be hungry at breakfast. Right. So you have to break that cycle at some point.
I mean, another thing that I've run into working with clients is, you know, I don't get home from work until 7 o'clock. And by the time I kind of get in the door and do some stuff, and then the kids have got to go to bed. And so I put the kids to bed, and then it's kind of like 8 or 9 o'clock before we're ready to sit down for dinner. And if I was in that position, I feel lucky that I'm not in that position, then I would not really eat a big dinner at that time, right? Like I would have the bulk of my calories earlier in the day. And so when I, you know, the 9 o'clock thing, it really would be just like a token gesture of food.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's really reasonable. And the other thing here that's important is consistency. So not having like a large dinner a couple days of the week and then having a large breakfast a couple days of the week, but training your body to be on some kind of routine or schedule with your meals.
Right. Consistency.
Yeah.
Okay. So we talked about blue light at night, going outside in the morning, the sun is definitely your friend, eating when the sun is up, caffeine we talked about, you're going to stop consuming caffeine after midday, the evening routine we talked about. What about alarm clocks? God, I haven't seen an alarm clock in a long time. I've never really had that problem, to be honest. I'm one of those people that wakes up as like whatever time the sun comes up. I've never needed an alarm clock. And actually, it works against me when I'm, you know, when you get one of those really early morning flights, that's a recipe for me to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning. It's a real pain in the bum. Do you see that much? Are people using alarm clocks?
Yes. And I think it's more of a manifestation of them being sleep deprived. And so they're having to wake themselves up with an alarm. But the problem with alarms is that a lot of times they wake you up in the middle of a sleep cycle versus when you're supposed to naturally wake up. And usually if you do wake up in the middle of the night, one thing we say is to not look at a clock. Two things will usually happen. One, you'll say, oh my gosh, it's 2 a.m. I'm still awake. and then you'll just lay there worrying about not sleeping. The other thing would be, oh my gosh, it's, you know, almost 4 a.m. and I have to get up soon anyway. And then you'll just get up and miss out on another hour or two of sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was definitely a revelation for me, that the worst thing you can do when you get up in the middle of the night to pee is to look at a clock. It just doesn't end well. Your brain is off to the races at that point. And actually, one good tip that our neurologist friend, Josh Turknet, who's here on the same deck that we're stood on, I feel like a bit of a fraud or an imposter, maybe is a better word. Like, we've got a medical doctor neurologist here sat on the deck, and we're the ones talking about sleep. It's fantastic. Josh's tip, he uses a white noise machine. I think it was just an app on his phone that he was using. And he has it set up so that the white noise turns off at the time he wants to wake up. And as soon as the white noise pops off, then he wakes up. And I can't say I've ever tried that, but that's kind of a cool tip.
That is smart. I like that.
Yeah. What else have we got? We got bone broth and chamomile tea. Tell about, you did some research on that. Oh, glycine. Yeah, glycine is something I use all the time.
The chamomile tea has been shown to help with sleep quality in at least older adults. The glycine is important because it kind of antagonizes glutamate, which is an excitatory.
Right.
So if you have the glycine, that's going to have a calming effect on the brain. Some people do find that there is a difference between supplementing with pure glycine versus supplementing with something like collagen powder, which does have glycine, but it also does have some glutamate in it. Mm. So there's a little bit of difference there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, your mileage definitely might vary. I feel like I've had really great results having 2 tablespoons of the Great Lakes collagen hydrosolate. Am I saying that correctly? Is that one of the things I've ever
read? Hydrolysate.
That, what Zach said. And I feel like that's been working really well for me. But Tommy said that he just wakes up in the middle of the night starving hungry, and he's done it like a number of times, and it consistently makes him wake up in the middle of the night starving hungry. So your mileage may vary there. Zach, is collagen something that you try and get people to work into their diets in general? Like, forget about sleep.
Yeah, definitely. Because, I mean, I'm definitely a big fan of protein. Like, we've talked on that about on the podcast before about the benefits of protein. But just, we don't consume a lot of, like Megan said, like the amino acid glycine. And so it really helps to balance all of that out. And it's been shown to be beneficial for joint and tendon health and things like that. So it's just hard to get with the typical protein foods we eat. So that's why I do usually recommend clients try to add that on top of their normal protein intake.
Have you got any sleep stack supplements, Clay? I'm sure it like varies from week to week, doesn't it? Have you been using anything in particular? Sleep Remedy. I had a freaking fantastic night of sleep. We're away traveling, and that's always a challenging environment.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say that Sleep Remedy. I mean, I had a couple of nights of not great sleep, but it's weird though. I'm like so much calmer about it now than I used to be, and that's kind of an interesting thing, isn't it? The last thing you want to do is panic about it, but you can't really tell someone to not panic.
Right. The better sleep you get, the less you stress over it.
Yeah, so. Exactly. I'm really not worried about it now. I'm just thinking, oh, I'm going to have an awesome night's sleep the night after. Mm-hmm. Doesn't really worry me too much. Some of the best tips are the paradoxical intentions. Have you ever tried that? It's kind of a fancy term. Mm-mm. So it just means, okay, I want you to lie there. It's like the... Don't think about polar bears. For the next 5 minutes, I want you to not think about a polar bear, right? You can't do it. And the same is true with sleep, right? I want you to lie there and concentrate on not going to sleep. Right? It's like the same thing as the box breathing, really.
Right.
But that's a really good one. Electromagnetic radiation. What do we know about that? I definitely turn my Wi-Fi off at night.
So do I. And it's a controversial topic. However, there is some evidence to suggest that it can kind of affect us in a negative way. And the other thing is, weigh the pros and cons of unplugging your Wi-Fi at night or turning on your phone on airplane mode. There's zero cons and many potential pros.
Right,
to that.
Right.
So,
and Tommy went into detail on this with Dr. McCullough, and I'll link to that episode in the show notes. Would you go as far as installing, you know, I've seen online these things, and it looks like a mosquito net, but it's a Faraday cage. Yeah. And they work. Like, you can see they work because you can see someone like in a video put the handheld meter inside and the reading goes to zero. Would you ever install a Faraday cage over your bed?
I would not say it's a low-hanging fruit. We'll leave it at that.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on. What about tracking sleep? This is definitely a big one that I deal with all the clients. And I'm almost like kind of annoyed with the Oura Ring people for releasing an algorithm that doesn't fucking work. Like, if you want to know how much deep sleep you got last night and you're wearing an Oura Ring, pop the Oura Ring in the bin. Send me an email and I will send you a random number that will tell you how much deep sleep that you got last night. That is how good the Oura Ring algorithm is at the moment. So I can cite a study in the show notes where independently validated the Oura Ring, and they found that the deep sleep detection was no better than chance. It is literally no better than a coin toss. So it detects when you're asleep very well, but forget about the stages of sleep data. Actually, Josh has posted some really great studies, or case reviews, I should say, in our Slack. This new thing they're calling
Orthosomnia,
which
is the perfectionistic quest for ideal sleep in order to optimize daytime function.
It's like happiness and orgasms. Like, the more you concentrate on it, the further it gets away, right? Have you been seeing this, Zach? Have you been saying, oh, you know, having people asking you to look at their sleep data, and you're looking at it going, you just need to stop tracking your sleep and you'll sleep great?
Oh, yeah. There's more examples than just the sleep. I think some data is definitely helpful to track, but I think, again, they're chasing numbers as opposed to really focusing on how they feel in general.
Right.
And it's not really going to change what you should do. I mean, if you see that you had a great night of sleep, is that going to change what you do when you see that you had a poor night of sleep? Like, we know the habits you should be doing. So I just think it just makes people overthink. And again, it's that stressor, and it creates that vicious cycle of, oh, shoot, I didn't sleep well. Like, maybe I should relax a little more today, or I'm not going to perform as well today. So many things like that.
Mm-hmm. I need to be careful here not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, as Simon frequently likes to point out to me, that self-monitoring is the cornerstone of behavior change, right? Like, good luck changing your behavior if you're not even monitoring what you're doing. So you have to be a bit careful here.
There are other things to monitor that are not directly sleep.
Exactly. So that, you just reminded me of another great point. So Dan Pardy pointed out on the podcast, I'm a huge fan of this advice: track the behaviors that lead to the thing you want, but not the thing you want, right? So set an alarm to go to bed. My thing is, like, Julie usually turns it on for me, the sauna, to warm up. And then once the sauna's hot, I'm getting in the sauna. And so, yeah, having that, the alarms to start the routine to get ready for bed, I think, are really helpful. And someone did send me once one of those, I can't remember which one, it was like a Fitbit thing, you know, like one of those straps that went around my wrist and tracks your sleep. And I think I wore it one night, and then the second night I found myself lying awake wondering what my sleep tracker was going to say the next day. Like, it was in the sock drawer with all the other gadgets the night after, never to be seen again.
It's like on the iPhone bedtime. There's an alarm that goes off that says, it's time to go to bed.
Yeah, that's a really good idea.
And my kids are like, what is that?
Yeah.
It's the reverse, but it's pretty awesome. It's like, if you plan on getting X number of hours, now's probably a good time to start doing that.
You mentioned earlier, Zach, timing your workouts. When's the best time to train?
There are some studies on this, and it's a little bit confounded because, I mean, for one, we don't want to train too late because that will impact sleep. But there are some studies showing, like, performance can be a little higher later in the day. Mm-hmm. But again, that can be confounded by the fact that you can get good at whenever you train. So the biggest thing is to be consistent when you train. That's what I would say. And just don't train too late. So yeah, just keep it simple.
Mm-hmm. We've definitely seen some clients that through the Dutch testing have seen a disrupted circadian rhythm that they know that was caused by training later in the day. I wouldn't do that at this point. Like, go smash it 8 o'clock at a CrossFit.
Yeah, that's what I would say. That's really the only rule. Like, just don't train too late. Outside of that, train when is reasonable for you and be consistent with that, because your body adjusts to when you train. So if you're used to training kind of late in the day, if you switch to the morning, expect your performance to drop a little bit initially, but over time you will adjust to that.
Mm-hmm. Megan, talk about seasonality. This is interesting, isn't it? I sort of hinted at it earlier that maybe my bedtime might vary according to the time of year. I mean, and that's something I think might happen naturally it's like one of those things that just happens without you really thinking about it too much. But there is some evidence that's worth talking about.
Yeah. So I guess we're at the Ancestral Health Symposium, so this even makes more sense to talk about. But
it's so paleo.
Yeah. The idea is that in the wintertime, when days are shorter and food, at least many, many years ago, was less abundant, then we would be having a shorter eating window. We would be going to bed earlier because the sun is setting earlier, versus in the summer when the days are longer, fruit and produce and more carbohydrates are in abundance. We are kind of expanding our eating window, eating with the season, and also maybe getting a little bit less sleep in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
That's the idea there.
Mm-hmm. And you had some great tips for jet lag as well, somewhat related subject maybe. You're kind of moving across the planet and the day is altering. What can we do about jet lag?
Right. So in my opinion, the best thing is to kind of get your body set a couple days or try adjusting to the new time zone a couple days beforehand.
Right. And doing that gradually.
Exactly. Yeah. So that you don't just get this huge jump. Exactly.
Right.
And then the other thing is, this might be a place for some smart melatonin supplementation when you get to your destination, just to kind of reset that melatonin onset.
Okay. Can you talk about the dose of melatonin? That's kind of important, isn't it?
Right. So many people go multiple milligrams to start with. We recommend starting with a very small amount, so maybe 0.3 to 1.5 milligrams.
Uh-huh. Okay. I've heard lots of athletes talk about this, you know, the pros that are doing European travel in particular, that it's a huge advantage to start early and then just work your day back. And you will just work your whole day back, right? You're not just like trying to go to bed at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You eat earlier, you train earlier, and just gradually step it back. And the melatonin hack is useful too.
A lot of athletes will travel overseas several days beforehand just to kind of adjust to that naturally. And that's why, just to get their bodies used to that.
Go camping, our favorite intervention. Tommy's written about this in our highlight series as well. Fantastic hack. And it's, again, Ancestral Health Symposium. If you just want to get the right results and you don't care about the details, just think about what would have happened 10,000 years ago and do that, right? But skip the death at childbirth and the infectious disease stuff and maybe ending up with an axe in your head at some point. But yeah, co-camping, I think, is a fantastic intervention. You get away from everything we've talked about, right? You get away from light at night. You get away from light pollution from streetlights. You probably get away from Wi-Fi. The only light you have is hopefully a campfire. It gets dark and then you go to bed. I think that's, you know, a wonderful thing to try. If you're wondering how much our modern environments are impacting your sleep, then just go camping. The only thing is, maybe your sleep environment is less than ideal. If you're a bit of a princess when it comes to your soft mattress, Megan, could you tell us about that?
Well, I wouldn't say I'm a princess when it comes to it, but let's just say that you have to be able to get at least slightly comfortable when you're camping if you want to be able to sleep at all.
So go camping. Bedroom environment, we talked about avoiding sleeping pills. I mean, obviously, we can't tell anyone ever to stop taking something that's been prescribed by a licensed physician, nor would we try. I personally tried some prescription sleep drugs and they didn't work. Ambien didn't work at all for me. Tell us what you know. You're not really sleeping, right? If you're under the assistance
It's very similar to alcohol in that you're kind of, you're
unconscious.
You can't be woken.
That's like one of Kirk's definitions of sleep. Right. Is like, I find a lot of things are like, they require the via negativa. You know, we have to define it in terms of what it's not. Mm-hmm. Right? Can you wake the person up? If the answer is no, then you're not asleep. You're unconscious.
Yeah. So it kind of provides that unconscious feeling, but it certainly doesn't provide the restful sleep in most cases. There are some, you know, if we're working with somebody and trying to help them get off a sleeping pill that's pharmaceutical grade, there are some smart supplementation that we can implement as well.
Right. I think this is important. 5-HTP has worked very well for me personally, and I've seen it work really well for a number of other people. We were talking about that with Josh earlier, weren't we? And he didn't really have any objections to it.
Yeah.
But like with anything like that, he doesn't really want you to see you using it for prolonged periods of time. I think he was worried about, like, once you stop taking it, are you in a worse place than when you started 6 months ago?
Yeah.
Again, you're always thinking in probabilities, which is worse, the possible effects of long-term 5-HTP use or the sleep deprivation. And personally, I'll take the 5-HTP any day. Mm-hmm. It's really good, like the monkey mind thing where you talk about writing things down to shut your brain down. I feel like 5-HTP does that for me, or I don't know. What do you think, Clay? Have you ever tried it?
Yeah, absolutely. And when you alluded to Doc Parsley's, I like Tommy's deconstructed version of that.
Mm-hmm.
It seems much simpler and you can implement bits and pieces of it, the 5-HTP or the low-dose melatonin or just the tea or all three together. I don't think, as Tommy once described, you don't want the sledgehammer to go to sleep. You need the gentle nudge.
Do you think we should give away Tommy's alternative sleep remedy?
I think so.
I'll put Tommy's alternative sleep remedy in the show notes for this episode. So that was one of the things that Kirk has talked about, was he put that cocktail, as it was called at that time, together for the elite warfighters who didn't want to go on a big shopping trip to put it. And it was very convenient. It is very convenient, like just having it all. I have the capsule form now. I know a lot of people didn't really like the drink, including me. But the capsules are great. And it's very convenient. But yeah, you can deconstruct it. If you don't want the pH GABA, right? The Phenibut, we're not too sure about that. So if you don't want that, and it's got a really high dose of vitamin D in it as well. So if you're taking that on top of your multivitamin, that can end up to being, we've seen people with a 25 hydroxy vitamin D up around 100 from long-term. And Clay's laughing because he was one of those people. I mean, so yeah, there's a trade-off, right? You have all of these things in one package and it's very convenient, but oh, wait, this doesn't really suit me. And so I need to deconstruct it and put together some different pieces. The schedule, we talked about gratitude and believing in a higher purpose. Who wants to talk about that?
I will. So this is really interesting and there's some actually decent science around it. But implementing some kind of gratitude practice is certainly beneficial for most everyone, but it can be particularly useful for people who are struggling with sleep. And also having a higher level of meaning and purpose in life has been associated with better sleep quality. So, I mean, this could be as simple as before you're going to bed, you could, if you're somebody who likes to journal, you can journal. If you're somebody who just likes to think about these things, you can think about these things. If you like to tell somebody about them, a loved one, you can tell somebody about them. But practicing gratitude and also believing in some kind of higher purpose or meaning in your life is important.
What about the AM version of that?
Yeah, I don't think it has to be right before you go to bed. Yeah, yeah, it's just in general.
Yeah.
Let's talk about chronotype. Megan, what do you know about chronotype?
So some people are just inherently night owls and some people are inherently morning people. Most people are somewhere in this kind of moderate range. Most people aren't like 4 a.m. people or 1 a.m. people as far as going to bed and waking up. If you do feel like you need to adjust your day and your sleep habits around maybe going to bed a little bit later if you're a night owl or waking up a little bit earlier if you're a morning person, that's totally fine. Just make sure that you're not doing that as a crutch for something else.
Mm-hmm. Well, Greg and Tommy went into some more detail in their episode, so maybe we should just refer people to there. But I know all of these, it's so fixed mindset, isn't it? We just the solutions in Mindset by Carol Dweck. Sorry, what's the question? And this is one of those things like, really? Or is it that you failed to entrain your circadian rhythm appropriately? And my suspicion working with people is that it's the latter, right? It's like, it's no, this is not your innate thing. It's just that you haven't entrained your circadian rhythm appropriately. Zach, do you run into many people who are cutting short their sleep in order to train?
Yes. Yes, that does come up a lot. And if that is really, truly the only time you have to train, then we would ideally work on getting you to bed earlier or something like that. But I also think many people are just doing too much. I mean, we've talked about this on the podcast a lot, but a workout does not need to take that long. So there are always ways to, you know, I work with clients to help them fit it in their schedule. For example, maybe splitting it up during the day, you know, do a little bit in the morning, do a little bit at your lunch break, you know, something like that. So there are options. But again, I know for some people that is the absolute only time they have, but I would not cut back. I mean, it's again, one of those sacrifice things. Like if you're only going to get 4 hours of sleep to get your workout in, like I would rather you sleep. So it is kind of context dependent, but there's usually ways to work around it.
Mm-hmm. What about napping? Do you ever recommend that people take a nap?
So I think it can be okay. I forget. It may have been the Potter podcast I was hearing on this. But, you know, I mean, the idea, I can't remember which podcast it was. But, you know, he was saying if you do it consistently for, you know, a fairly short period of time, it can be okay.
Tell me what you've seen. I know, yeah, so Greg and Tommy did talk about napping. Mm-hmm. What have you seen as a coach working with clients?
Yeah, so it actually hasn't come up for me that often with clients.
Okay.
So I don't have a lot of experience with it, but I mean, if it is something that's needed, if they are sleeping, you know, and not getting much sleep, I think it's okay. But I haven't really had that conversation much often.
Yeah, I used to love a good kip underneath my desk at the hedge funds. Like you look into my office, it looked like no one's in there, but actually I was asleep underneath my desk. I couldn't imagine doing that now. It's kind of weird.
Because your lifestyle wasn't like it is now, right?
A lot of things have changed. I wouldn't like to. Actually, this is a really good place to summarize is that I think that's really the essence of MBT is we're not just one dimension. You know, we love the low carb conferences and all of our favorite people are there. And I enjoy hearing about all the fantastic results that people are getting eating low carbohydrate diets. And I love hearing about the mechanisms and the exogenous ketones and all of that stuff. But eventually it becomes quite boring because it's just so one dimensional. And there's all these other dimensions that are so important to health and of which sleep is just one, right? I mean, I think that's what the podcast has been, is this deep exploration of all the other things that might contribute to our health. Super important. So maybe just another quick summary, because this has been quite a long episode and maybe some people have forgotten about some of the things that we talked about at the start. So let's start the circadian rhythm, right? Let's talk about the cycle. So first thing in the morning, a great night of sleep starts first thing in the morning. The first thing we do is go outside, get some bright light. Caffeine use, if you're going to do it, make it early on. Early time restricted eating. So we're eating breakfast like a king, lunch like a prince, dinner like a pauper. We're moving our socialization maybe earlier into the day, working out earlier, but not too early, right? You don't want to get up early to work out. And as you said, Zach, there is some evidence pointing that people might get better results in the early afternoon. Mm-hmm. Would you say?
Performances.
What else did I miss? Sure. Can someone help me out here with things that I might have missed?
The avoiding blue light at night. One thing I just want to say real quick on that is, it's great to wear the blue blocking glasses in to install Iris or Flux or whatever on your computer. But you also have to remember that if you're replying to emails 5 minutes before you go to bed, which
that's tough,
I have been guilty of this, you'll still be getting that stimulation from whatever you're doing on the computer or if you're watching TV with those blue blocking glasses. So you have to remember that, yes, there is the blue light, but there's also the stimulation of whatever you're looking at.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that brings up the importance of just having a wind down routine. Like we said, you know, relax mm-hmm. a little bit, make sure you get into that calm down state, optimize your bedroom environment, you know, minimize the lights, get the bedroom cool, whatever temperature you find beneficial, although erring on the side of a little bit cooler seems to be more beneficial.
Oh yeah, of course, the bedroom environment, making sure that's all dialed. Okay, that's a great summary. Okay, so what do you do then? Like, okay, Chris, I've tried all of that and some other things you didn't even talk about. And my sleep still sucks. And I'm still getting up 3 times in the night to pee. Well, then I think that's an appropriate time to start looking inside. I'm an engineer and I do like to look inside of systems to see why they're not working properly. Like, when did this go wrong? Like, were you always a crappy sleeper? Or is this something that happened more recently? Well, what changed? What went wrong? And the way that we do that investigation is through our Elite Performance Program. And we take a really deep dive. We use blood chemistry, we use urine and stool testing. We're going to look at your circadian rhythm using urinary hormones. And if one of the things is drinking, you're ready to give up booze or caffeine or anything else that you're struggling to change your behavior with, then we've got the fantastic Dr. Simon Marshall that can help you with that. We've got Zach, we've got Megan, we've got Clay. Tommy's the architect of our program. I really think of us as the, actually, Megan, you're more of a kind of architect builder role. And Zach, that's true as well. Clay and me, I think we're just like we're the sausage fingered builders that show up on site. We do all of our coaching remotely via Zoom. So it doesn't matter where you are in the world. If you're interested in hearing a bit more about how we might work together, you can come to the front page of our website, nourishbalancethrive.com. And right there, you'll find a button that you can press and you can book a free starter session where we can talk about some of your history and some of the challenges you're facing with your sleep. And then maybe we can figure out a way that we could work together. Or maybe we can make a recommendation for something else you could try or someone else you could work with if maybe we're not such a great fit. At the time of recording, it's Megan and Clay who are doing those starter sessions. So I hope this was helpful. Let me know if it wasn't helpful. If there's something else we should consider or talk about, please let me know. You can come and leave a comment in the comments section over at nourishbalancethrive.com/podcast. Thanks very much for your time, guys. It's been great.